University, the voice of Reichman University.
There is something to take refuge in here, which is the refuge of knowing that you're doing all that you can, that 99% of what's coming at you is out of your control, but you are taking control of the 1%. That's under your influence. You're taking control of what you say to your children. You're taking control of the steps you walk, of what's happening inside your thoughts and feelings, or especially you're taking control of your relationship to them. And then you let go, you know, and you give up. And it's a scary thing to say, but there's great inner peace in knowing that most of it's out of your control. And you live in the moment, not knowing what the future brings.
Welcome to Raw, a podcast where we confront the complexities of war from the inside out. I'm Anouk, a journalist, author, yoga teacher, and meditation practitioner. Raw, or war spelled backwards, symbolizes how many of us feel in the face of the Israel-Gaza conflict, exposed, vulnerable, and seeking understanding. Here, we don't just discuss the external battles, but dive deep into our internal struggles, examining how this violence has shaken our very core. Join me in conversations with philosophers, psychologists, and spiritual leaders as we explore how to navigate these painful times with wisdom and resilience, finding guidance for our own paths through this raw, unfiltered world.
Good to see you. Thank you for being here. How are you?
Why, many things. I laugh sometimes. It feels like the surface of my mind is like rush hour traffic in Rome, where I was there sometime, drivers going every which way. But the space between the drivers and the ground in which they're moving truly, truly does feel just blessed and content and peaceful. And I know there are many reasons leading to that, including genetic lottery, good luck, and advantage, which then adds up to privilege. All that said, I do feel pretty blessed with all that. And there's a lot of traffic. Concern about the world, family health issues floating around in other people in my system.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
A lot. And in that, of course, a lot of compassion and heart for you. Yeah.
Thanks, Rick. Before we start, or maybe as we start, I just want to say that I'm not in the studio because the studios are closed. Yeah, everything's closed. My kids are at home, so we might hear some screams and shouts. And if at any moment I hear a siren, I have to go shelter with my kids. So yeah, that's just the preface. But I still felt like I wanted to do this.
It just feels so appropriate and timely.
So I want to welcome everyone back to Raw and welcome to you, Rick, and say that today's episode is a bit different. I just mentioned it. I'm recording from home. My voice is a little hoarse. I'm a little sick. Our studio is closed due to the ongoing missile barrages from Iran. And my children are here with me, hiding somewhere watching TV. And it's evening here in Israel. So like so many people around me, I am navigating fear, fatigue, and uncertainty. And yet it felt very important and timely, like you said, Rick, to record this conversation. So we're joined today by someone whose work I've turned to again and again. I was going to say in moments like this, but I have not experienced moments like this before, but in difficult moments, Dr. Rick Hansen. Rick is a psychologist, senior fellow at UC Berkeley's Greater Good Science Center, and a New York Times bestselling author whose books, including Hardwiring Happiness, Buddha's Brain, and Resilient, bridge neuroscience, mindfulness, and practical tools for emotional strength. He has spent decades helping people understand how the brain changes under stress and how it can also heal, grow, and become more resilient. His work is deeply rooted in science, but also speaks to the human spirit. When Rick and I spoke recently, he brought up epigenetics, how trauma can be biologically passed from one generation to the next, and how that might shape the emotional and psychological landscape of communities living in ongoing conflict. That includes, of course, Israelis, where I am, shaped by the Holocaust, displacement, and decades of war, as well as, of course, Palestinians and others, Iranians at the moment, etc. But I think that perhaps epigenetics, and Rick, you'll tell me more about that, also offers a lens of hope. That positive experiences, moments of safety, of connection, of great compassion, can also change our biology, and maybe even in times like these. So today we'll explore how we can stay connected to ourselves, to one another, and to our inner strength, even in the midst of war, fear, and heartbreak. So Rick, welcome, and deep bows of gratitude to you for agreeing to this.
Well, I really appreciate the introduction, Anouk. And I want to express from my heart the fact that we are doing this literally right now while two countries are at war and related military action, some of which involves my own country with its current president, are really in play. And wow, it's just all this happening. And I feel for it. And I think it's an important backdrop for what we're talking about here. You know, humanity has the widest behavioral repertoire of any species on the planet. It's a fancy way of saying humans can be wonderful and horrible in how they treat each other and, frankly, how they treat themselves. And we're in the context of that full spectrum right now. And it's easy to intellectualize about it, and people sometimes avoid the realness of it all by resorting to fancy abstractions. And there's a small place for useful abstractions, but mainly I think it's really important to let it land. You know, the foundation of empathy is letting it land, what it's like for other people.
Yeah. So I think this conversation is just, you mentioned it before we started, couldn't be more prescient and relevant to what we're going through. And even though I'm living in a region in conflict, in a time of great difficulty in war, most of my interviews, I come to them with a little bit of space. Usually I have that drive from home to the studio where I generally listen to music. And in the past year and a half of war and tragedy, I've had that kind of ability to come to the studio with a little bit of intellectualizing, like you mentioned, a little bit of distance from what's happening. This interview, I feel, is a little bit different because I am absolutely in the thick of it. I mean, I think a moment ago, a few minutes before we started, I was feeling really the deep existential dread in my body, the heart racing, the kind of thoughts racing, ruminating, not really being able to be present, fear, so much uncertainty. And so I just want to name that because I'm here with one of the people I admire the most in the world. And I would like that reality to be present in this interview. I was just talking to my producer as well, Tama, and she said that she doesn't know, her body, her mind doesn't know how to behave, what to feel in this time, and that she's deeply affected by the atmosphere around her. She was saying that she was speaking to one friend who said she's not worried. In fact, a few days ago, she slept on the beach and she felt that she was protected. And then she spoke to another friend of hers who's brilliant and smart and knows a lot about geopolitics, who said, I think things might really get out of hand. And I think we should try to flee, perhaps through the Egyptian border. And as she was hearing these different people talk and share their experience, her body was kind of adopting their sense of fear or safety. And that's what I find also during the course of the day, whether I'm speaking with you right now, I feel my nervous system relaxing. Like I said, a few minutes before, I read a headline and it just brought me back into that loop of fear. So just starting there, any thoughts about that and about, should we try to be surrounding ourselves with the people who really nurture our sense of safety, even when that might not be realistic? Should we try to soothe our nervous systems, even in moments where we feel that our existence might be threatened?
Yeah. So I've never had a life anything like yours. Full stop.
Yeah.
It's also true that I've learned a lot and studied a lot about how to manage threats. And I've had a fair amount of personal experience, you know, in wilderness settings, just choosing to be there, that were very threatening. And it's really important to realize that there can be threats, and they're real threats. Okay. And meanwhile, we can feel a core of calm strength in how we manage the threats, with anxiety that's in proportion to the threat around the edges, while still functioning from a core of calm strength, that secure base inside ourselves. That is crucially important to realize that's really possible. And it's a good thing to cultivate. So how do we cultivate that core of calm strength? One aspect of it is to appreciate that we are vulnerable as a species to social contagion, and different people are more vulnerable than others by both innate temperament and acquired characteristics. So there's social contagion, how much we're influenced by people around us. And then there's epigenetics and life experience. So if we've acquired a sensitivity to threat through our lifetime of being in threatening situations, little brain stuff. When you are stressed, cortisol is released, goes up into your brain. And what it does there is like a 1-2 punch. It both stimulates and sensitizes over time, sensitizes the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala, technically two of them on either side of the middle of the brain. And it weakens a nearby part of the brain, the hippocampus, which regulates and downregulates the amygdala. And the hippocampus also enables us to create a sense of the bigger picture, the wider context. And the hippocampus tells the hypothalamus, another little bit of hardware in the brain, to calm down and quit calling for stress hormones. So you can see there's a 1-2 punch here that in our personal lives, when we get anxious or alarmed or stressed or angry or stressed in other kinds of ways, rushing about, dealing with things, that sensitizes our brain. It makes the brain even more reactive and more prone to being upset and rattled and hijacked. That's just our personal life. And so being aware of that priming, just from our personal life, we'll do epigenetics next, but just in our personal life, being aware of the priming that we carry with us, that we're predisposed, is extremely useful. Because then you can notice that your body, let's say, is in a state of dread or alarm. And this could apply to a war. There's a war right now, call it whatever you like, between Israel and Iran. Or it just could be a business situation or a family situation or a partner. When you know that you're already primed to go red, then when your body starts getting upset, if you have mindfulness, if you have some self-awareness, you can get some space around it. You can realize, oh, my body is cranked up right now. And it's there. I can have compassion and should have compassion for myself, but I do not need to overestimate what it means. My autonomic nervous system, my hormones, they're rolling, but I do not have to be hijacked by them. I can be separate from them. I can recognize all that as like a car alarm going off that is unpleasant and worrisome, but it's meaningless. It's not useful information. And that's an incredibly good thing to know, that you are not your anxiety. You can be separate from your anxiety. You can use it as information. To the extent that anxiety is useful, it's informative. There's a term, signal anxiety. But if it's out of proportion to what's happening, if it's not adding value, you're already dealing with the threat from a place of calm strength. You don't need to add the dread in your belly. It actually erodes your capacity to deal with the threat. It's not helpful besides making you suffer. When you know that, you cannot take it so seriously. And over time, you can retrain yourself so you're not so vulnerable to that kind of anxiety that distorts things and makes you, you know, go in wrong directions.
So for me, at least, this has been a process that has taken me years to acquire these tools and mindfulness, etc. But in this time of war, I guess to kind of give it specific example, it might mean, for example, that when the sirens go off, I know I have to run to the shelter. In that moment, it makes absolute sense for my body's stress hormones to be elevated, for my heart rate to rise, and for me to be able to be in that fight, flight, freeze moment so I can grab my kids really quickly and go to the shelter. Afterwards, knowing the information that I know that we have a shelter in my home, in my case, I'm very lucky that we have this system of prior notice through our phones, I might then notice that my body is still in that state of fight, flight, freeze, for example, when I'm cooking with my kids or when I'm in the shower. And perhaps that's the time that I might notice that this anxiety is not really serving me right now. And in fact, that I'm feeding it with information that I'm consuming on social media and in the news and thoughts that I am ruminating. Is that what you mean in a kind of practical sense?
Yeah. So I don't like being afraid. I don't like the experience. I'm kind of temperamentally prone to it. And it's really, really, really important to remember that we can function at a high level. We can respond to threat. We can be vigilant. We can be prudent. We can be tough. We can fight back. We can be fiery, all without being hijacked by fear. Just realizing that that's possible and recognizing people for whom that's true. There's anxiety maybe around the edges, but in the core of their being, they are doing what they need to do without being invaded by anxiety in its various forms. So we can help ourselves in the moment not be flooded by and hijacked by anxiety that isn't helpful. And each person gets to decide how much anxiety is helpful. If you want to feel a lot of it, or you think it's okay, if it's helpful for you, if it adds value to what you're going to do anyway, okay. But otherwise, in the moment, you could do specific things that people do when they function in threatening situations to keep reminding yourself that the actual odds of that missile landing on your home, on your head, on your children right now are actually extremely low. I'm not in any way trying to minimize anything, and I recognize I've never lived through a war. I've never been in a country that's been under historical attack, you know, as Israel has. That said, factually, the odds are actually really low. You can remind yourself of that, and you can remind yourself that in this moment, there's a kind of radical acceptance. I am doing everything I can. I'm grabbing my kids. I'm moving out the door. I'm grabbing the teddy bear with me along the way. I'm doing everything I can. There are things you can do in the moment. You can try to regulate your breathing. You can try to calm your body. You can bring in a sense of social support. Love is flowing out and flowing in. You are caring for others. You are centered in your love for them and your duty to them. And there are others who are caring for you. And you're in a larger network, fanatical fools. So you can remind yourself of these things in the moment. Now, that's the least of it, because in the moment, it's really hard. We walk in the moment with the body that we have in the circumstances we're in that, as I've been emphasizing, has already learned to be fearful, learned in the broadest sense. We are scared monkeys. We are scared, sociable monkeys. That's who we are. And so the brain is designed to learn from threat, a history of threat. And so that learning is baked into our body. So that's where we are. And so therefore, for me, it's really important when the sirens are not blaring and you're not racing out the door with your kids, what can you do to decondition the fear learning in you? And what can you do to condition, to learn, to acquire a sense of deep resilience, really, whose core is well-being and inner peace and love, no matter what? What can you do to do that offstage, you know, or when the sirens are not blowing. That's the really important part, because that's what we then bring into the next time the missiles are flying.
I think that relates to the negativity bias, which I know you talk about. I believe you said that the brain is like Velcro for bad experiences and Teflon for good ones, meaning we are, from an evolutionary standpoint, wired to kind of latch on to the bad experiences. Yeah. So, and especially in times of change and uncertainty, we kind of look for what could go wrong. And like you said, it's not necessarily kind of rationally sane to do that, because the chances of the missile falling on my home right now might not require my body to be flooded with so much anxiety and fear and dread. What are some of the kind of simplest practices or thoughts or exercises that you either personally have done or have found with people around you can help in moments to kind of regulate a dysregulated nervous system, a very fearful nervous system?
Yeah.
Is it about grounding the body in the present moment, kind of feeling where we are in this moment? I often talk about, you know, really feeling that our feet are on the ground, that my body is right here, right now, because that's what our minds tend to do, is forget that we're actually here. We go into all these thoughts about what the Ayatollah's next move might be, or what the Israeli army's next move might be, and Putin and Trump. And suddenly I found myself at the table of these leaders when actually I'm right here. My body's right here. And just remembering that, for me at least, can really ground me and kind of lower that kind of pressure cooker feeling inside. Are there other tools that you like and have found useful?
So there's what we can do in the moment when we're triggered. And then there's what we can do in all those other moments when the missiles are not flying, let's say, or the person is not yelling at us across the dinner table in different kind of contexts. What you said is essentially, it's really true. We can train. That's what's so hopeful. In other words, I had a moment of truth when I was about 15. I realized that no matter how bad my life had been, I could always learn a little more each day. I could grow a little. The future was hopeful, as the proverb puts it, the undiscovered country. So that's the idea here. And it's not airy-fairy. In other words, the more horrible your circumstances are, the more important it is to build up inner strengths. We sometimes think that what you and I are talking about, this area of psychology and mindfulness and personal growth, let's say, is for airy-fairy yoga camp. No, it's really for when you're in the bunker, et cetera. And so what are you doing? You're building up inner strengths. Great. What are the inner strengths you're going after? It really helps to know the goal. This is common sense for your mind, just like it's common sense for fixing a car or dealing with a health problem. What's your goal? Well, let's say I'm trying to grow a resting state calm in my set, in my core. I'm trying to grow the capacity to stand back from my understandable reactions. There's nothing wrong with them. You're designed to be freaked out by evolution. Our ancestors who were not freaked out when things happened did not pass on their genes. So we're supposed to get freaked out. Okay. You're trying to grow that mindful separation, let's say. Let's say you're also trying to grow compassion for yourself, that warm-heartedness for yourself. Well, I've just named three things: a core of calm strength, a sense of grit and determination and moxie inside yourself, which for me is absolutely bone deep in the Israeli character and you know, in the Jewish people throughout history. And also you're growing mindfulness, the capacity to step back from reactions, to watch the movie rather than being glued to the screen. And you're growing the heart, you know, heart for yourself and heart for others. Those three things, the next time the missiles fly, if you train in those three things a little bit, you will be a little bit more resilient and a little less reactive the next time, you know, the red light starts flashing, for example. Those three, I really named them, that sense of calm in your body and grit and determination, mindfulness and compassion. I think also there's a strength that it might sound sometimes a little annoying when people hear it. But on the other hand, I take great lessons from people who've lived through horrible conditions, including Viktor Frankl, A Jewish man, of course, well known, lived through the Holocaust himself in the camps, who essentially said that in the core of our being is that most fundamental freedom to choose how we will respond to our circumstances, even if there's nothing our bodies can do differently. But in the innermost being, we have existential choice and therefore responsibility there. There is something to take refuge in here, which is the refuge of knowing that you're doing all that you can, that 99% of what's coming at you is out of your control, but you are taking control of the 1% that's under your influence. You're taking control of what you say to your children. You're taking control of the steps you walk. You're taking control of what's happening inside your thoughts and feelings, or especially you're taking control of your relationship to them as they arise. And then you let go, and you give up. And it's a scary thing to say, but again, people who've lived through these horrible things will say it. There's great inner peace in knowing that most of it's out of your control. And you live in the moment, not knowing what the future brings.
If you're enjoying this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to Raw on your favorite podcast platform, leave a review, and share it with someone who might find it meaningful. You can also explore more about the show and subscribe to my newsletter at withanuk.com.
And in the moment, you can take refuge in the knowing that you are actually basically all right now. You're running to the shelter. You're processing the person across the dinner table who's yelling at you. But in the core of your being, you're still here, still going. At this point, I tend to swear in my mind. I won't do it on this recording, but it's like...
You can. In Israel, we swear, okay. Of course.
I mean, there's an existential statement. I'm going to do it. Fuck you. I'm going to live well meanwhile, in the core of my being. That's not about a spiritual bypass or any kind of resort. It's existential. It basically says, I see you. That's what the Buddha mythically or actually did on his own awakening. I see you, Mara. I see you, forces of delusion and darkness and despair and trouble and all the rest of that. And I'm still here. Moment by moment by moment until I'm not. And there's a refuge in that.
Just hearing you speak, I feel my heart opening and softening and really allowing myself to feel the various emotions. And I think when you say, fuck you, it's a beautiful permission for me to actually connect with the rage in me and the feeling that I will not allow the forces of darkness to inhabit me completely.
Exactly.
It's a kind of shield.
Beautiful.
And so perhaps for the audience also, permission to swear in any way you want and really imagining the very dark and powerful forces in the world and maybe kind of visualizing, keeping them at bay, keeping them, at arm's length, far away, and feeling the light and the wholeness that still remains in you.
Yeah, and part of this is radical responsibility and radical surrender. In other words, taking real responsibility for what you can affect, which is mainly in your own mind stream. Okay, and alongside that, to just give up. I have no control over what Donald Trump does or the Ayatollah in Iran or Benjamin Netanyahu. I don't. There's so much. And you just kind of give up. Honestly, I don't have local control over whether in the next moment a blood vessel bursts in my brain and there's a stroke. I just don't. I mean, we don't have control. One of the horrible things, your children are kind of middle-ish child, I don't know if they're yet driving distances with friends, going places. Yeah. Your kid goes off somewhere and you don't know that one in a million chance of a car accident or something else or whatever. So there's a place for just giving up. I mean, again, for listeners, you might think of two lists. I can, okay, fill in the blank. And I can't. Yeah. I can't stop the missile from falling here. I can't. I can take shelter, or whatever that might be.
Yeah. There's two things I want to say here. First is that one of the benefits, one of the good things we have in Israel is that public schools are, there's almost no private school system. It's all public schools, and they're all like minutes walking distance from home. So all my kids' friends are our neighbors.
They're beautiful.
And so it's a lovely sense of community. And that's really a beautiful thing, where we all wake up in the morning and we've gone through the same shit the night before. Yeah. We were woken up with the sirens and our kids were crying. And there's that sense of community, which I think you mentioned, yeah, we're fearful monkeys, but we're also highly social monkeys. And just that feeling that we're together in it, I think that's what keeping a lot of our nervous systems a little bit more regulated. Yes, yeah. Yes. That hug, that laugh, that, you know, what I can't, you know, and don't put it into words. It's just a kind of surreal reality that we're living through together. And the second, when you talked about the I can and I can't, of course, is the serenity prayer, which, yeah, I love, which asks God or whichever force you'd like to, yeah, speak to, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change and the courage to change the things I can and the wisdom to always know the difference. And I think that's where a lot of us, and I falter, is sometimes not allowing for that wisdom that really knows the difference. I think when I refresh my news browser for the 100th time in a day, if I were to listen to my wisdom, I would know that going and hugging my kids and doing some gentle breathing exercises and looking up at the sunlight or breathing in some fresh air, yeah, even though none of us are venturing very far from our homes these days. But that would probably serve me and actually serve my family and my community a lot more than reading some news reporter's assessment of how many missiles Israel has left or Iran has left, because that's really out of my control.
Yeah.
So thank you also for reminding me of that, because I think if we tap into that inner wisdom, we really do know mostly what is in our control and what isn't.
Yeah.
And we do have so much control over the kind of direct lived reality of what happens in our own body and what happens in those around us. And that's where I also like this idea that you don't have to be the perfect parent. You just have to be a present parent. And I have a question there is for parents, especially. I know a lot of our listeners are parents, is how do you remain present and connected with your kids when you are so afraid? And I think that's that for me, at least in moments where I have felt very afraid, it's almost compounded by the fear that I'm feeling would be transmitted to my kids. And then it's like a vicious loop.
Well, my very first book was called Mother Nurture, How to Nurture Mothers and Over the Long Haul. And so I have a deep feeling for children. If you want to do the best thing you can for children, take good care of their mothers and the system in which mothers are, including their partners and communities. So that's definitely a lot of background, a deep love for children. I've worked as a child psychologist and all that. So kids, speaking of social contagion, they are picking up their complete vibe, including subtle, who knows, energies, they're getting it. So one of the best things you can do for your children is to train yourself in the ways that I'm talking here when you do have the opportunity. There are certain moments where all we can do is survive. We just get through. And there are certain times where there's a place for panic and terror, and it's appropriate because it's very energizing. But usually it lowers functioning. It degrades function to be that upset about things. One of the best things you can do for your family is to train in this core of resilience inside yourself in the little ways you can in everyday life, like we've been talking about. The brain is really fast. There's a saying, neurons that fire together can wire together. So when you are experiencing, this is Coach Rick talking here, you want to train your brain for the better, you know, in less than a few minutes a day. When you are experiencing whatever you want to grow, stay with that experience for a breath or longer. Keep the neurons firing together so they can really, really wire together. Try to feel it in your body and be aware of what is rewarding or meaningful, what's enjoyable or meaningful about it, all of which will tend to hardwire that stuff into you. Great. It's one of the best things you can do for your kids, or to build those little strengths along the way, breath at a time, a synapse at a time. Great. Then in the moment, what can you do? Obviously, I've never been in that situation. It seems to me that what you could do is to be real. Children, you know, usually are very underestimated by their parents. I think a lot of us as adults know what I'm talking about when we were kids ourselves. So being real with them, I mean, it's happening. They understand it. And the chance of something bad happening to us right now is really, really small. And focusing on facts that are protective, you know, the Iron Dome or just the shelters, who we are, just focusing on that, really, really, really important. And as you say, I think being in the present, just one step at a time, just what's the next step? And the step after that, and the step after that is really helpful. And then, you know, again, I say as someone who's never been through that sort of a thing, but has definitely been in personally really hazardous situations in wilderness, grim humor. You know,
I love grim
an attitude humor. Also of swearing, whatever swearing or the equivalent is, that's really helpful. A sense of camaraderie with others. And also a lot of research on this, what enables people to go through horrible situations and not develop PTSD, post-traumatic stress. I won't call it a disorder, I'll call it reactions, is a sense of larger meaning. Fleeing is loving. Huh. Grieving is loving, right? Taking shelter is loving. Being with each other is loving. We are family, or whatever that might be. You know, we are part of a nation that is protecting itself from attack. That sense of common purpose or larger meaning in what is happening is really important. Like kids, there's a line here where we don't want to parentify the child. That's a fancy term. We don't want to burden them with responsibility for our state of mind. They're kids. We're not. We're doing our job as adults. A detail for us to have the sufficient authority and power to take care of them, to fulfill our responsibilities. We need to have power. We're in charge. We're the parents. We're the grownups here. That said, you know, as appropriate, big sister, little brother, hey, honey, you can help your little brother get through this. Make sure to bring his bunny, his bear. One of the problems in modern society a lot is that we infantilize our kids, especially like from 6, 7, 8, and especially teenagers, giving them roles too. You can help us accomplish our purpose here, our mission, you know, our aims. They like that. You have a role. You're part of it. We really appreciate you. Our family needs you, right? I didn't have much sense of that, you know, when I was a kid growing up. I was just imagining right here how much it would have meant to me if my dad or my mom had turned to me and really, Rick, because I respect you as a 12-year-old or a 7-year-old, you can really help your younger sister here in some way. Not as a burden on me, but as a communication of respect for me that I could step into that role. These are different examples.
Yeah. Again, I thought about a few things when you mentioned Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning. And I think it's he who said a quote that was also apparently said by Hirsch Goldberg Polan, who was a hostage who was murdered by Hamas and who said it to fellow hostages. And it really gave them a lot of meaning. He said, "He who has a why can find any how." And apparently he said it to his fellow hostages in the tunnels, and it really strengthened them. And so, yeah, I'd like to kind of come back to that, to mention that a sense of meaning. And usually for me, a sense of meaning is love, you know, love without sounding too gooey, love for our children, love for our world, yeah. Love for our own inner lives. And that's sometimes hard for people because people tend to be harder on themselves than on others. But if we can really reconnect to that sense of meaning, you know, why does this hurt so much? Why am I so afraid? why am I so angry? Why am I feeling this dread? It's because I love, because I love life. I love my kids. I love my country. I love fellow human beings. I love nature. And so connecting perhaps with that sense of meaning allows us to better understand and accept this anxiety or this dread or this anger that might arise.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Can I turn the table slightly?
Yes, of course. You're right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
So this is about something that I've been feeling more and more as we've been speaking. In you, in your own mind, your own psyche, your own being, do you have a sense of layers of it? This is often how people experience it, kind of, or I do. I'm going to use words that people can change for their own experience. That somewhere, in other words, there's a layer of being in you, or a core or a depth of being that is deeper than personality, deeper than gender. And it itself is always intact. And it feels deep down like a core that's unshakable, of a calm knowing and a quality of contentment and inner peace and love that's fundamental. Do you have any sense of that in yourself?
Thank you, first of all, for asking the question, because I think, again, just hearing you say those words allows me to reconnect with those feelings that I have been blessed to feel in the last few years of my life. Not to go too much into personal storylines, but I come from complex trauma from childhood. I have a disposition for anxiety, very severe anxiety, and just a general sense of existential dread. And of course, in times like this, you know, it hits the nail on the head. Yeah. But I have found these moments of real peace, of real calm, of real kind of acceptance, where either in meditation or sometimes in water, or when I listen to music. I'm sure you know that feeling when you listen to a beautiful piece of music and a tear streams down your face. And that for me is the moment where I feel both that the tragedy of life and the beauty of life are intertwined and they're dancing together. And I see both the beauty and the pain, and it makes me tear up. And that's usually when you're talking about that sense of deeper knowing. I think that's where I found it. And it's true that, you know, just this morning, I took a few minutes to be outside and I listened to beautiful piano music, and I just moved kind of intuitively, and I listened to the birds, and I just suddenly had this, this reconnection with something so much deeper, so much wiser, so much more ancient and old and simultaneously sorrowful and loving than all these stories. It's like suddenly I can see the stories of humans fighting one another and the battles across the ages and the good guys and the bad guys and the dehumanization that happens on all sides and the stories of division and polarity and hatred that feed us. And on the other hand, there is that other frequency, which maybe people listening to me right now are going to, you know, who think, what kind of gooiness is that? But I think that it's there. It's just a different frequency. And our world is so deeply tuned into the frequency of division and hatred and dehumanization. I feel myself being deeply affected by it, where there are times where I feel deeply dehumanizing of others. Mm-hmm. Of course, being in a sense of a state of threat heightens that. Media cycle in Israel and around the world heightens that. But yeah, I do want to say that there is another frequency.
Yeah. That level, I'll just call it being or beingness. And it's innate. I just want to point to it. It's innate. People report it around the world. Whatever might be true in ultimate reality, it is innate in our innermost being somehow, our psychology, that sense of a core or an underlying, unshakable witnessing of experiencing that has a benevolent quality to it. It's a loving and wise ongoingness of witnessing and awareness. That's accessible. And the more that people can train, you know, or in accessing what's always already true, inside themselves that really serves them, whether it's the oatmeal across the table or the missiles across the sky start to fly. That's really important. And related to that, it's true that, as T.S. Eliot put it in this beautiful poem, Ash Wednesday, teach us to care and not to care. We have there the combination of compassion and equanimity. It's really important to care about many things. Okay. It's also true that there's a place where we don't care, not in the sense of apathy or indifference or futility or no, it's just a profound inner peace, profound. We don't care, partly because it's so out of our control. Also, it's the vastness of all. And also, frankly, we're in touch with that core of being, which is fundamentally imperturbable. We sorrow at the world while simultaneously being in touch with a part of ourselves that is independent of it. That's very important, to care and to not to care. And then there's the proper balance of that. And people often will report that to the extent they're kind of accessing something in reality altogether, or even in the ultimate ground of reality, the absolute, and people relate to that differently, in those depths is also an absolute, fundamental, unshakable stability of peacefulness that is accessible for us. And accessing that and being in contact with it in our actual experience while running for shelter will help us run for shelter more effectively and while also feeling better in the process.
If you could leave our listeners with one or two simple practices, daily practices that you think would be really beneficial. And I just also want to again emphasize that you talk about not only having beneficial experiences, but really allowing them to land in our body and our psyche because of that negativity bias where we tend to kind of overlook the positive experiences. And then tell us some exercises that you think would be really beneficial for anyone listening, whether they have done any wellness practices or not.
Sure. We have a tremendous power to actually learn a little and heal a little and grow a little every day. And the crux of that is the deliberate internalization of experiences that are helpful to us, so that we're not just passively watching the movie go by, but, you know, a handful of times each day in the flow of life, and maybe a little formally, like at a meal where you just take a moment for gratitude or prayer or waking up or going to bed or, you know, formal moments of meditation, let's say, or spiritual practice, we deliberately have an opportunity to take in the good. So in those moments, like I've said, just stay with the experience. We usually just zooms on by, or it's dislodged by the next news flash, or the person who's interrupting us, or the mind's tendency to chase the next shiny or threatening object in awareness. Stay with it for a breath or longer, feel it in your body, tune into what's rewarding about it. There's tons of freely offered material, including guided practices by me on my website, rickhanson.com. So, you know, just, you can do that. That's fantastic. When so much around us is out of our control, really, and being aware of the vast number of causes in the moment, like the current moment is part of the fraught and complex history of 100 years in the Middle East, which stretches back thousands of years, links to colonialism and all kinds of stuff. When you realize the complexity of all that, it actually can bring you to peacefulness about what you can't affect. And then it focuses you on what you can affect. And like I said, one thing you can affect is how you grow a little every day. So I'd say that's really important. And then if I'll share my personal go-tos, I'm a nice guy, blah, blah. I'm also very independent, kind of feisty. And I won't say that I don't like being controlled. I don't like being controlled by my mind. And so, so it's kind of in that context too, that I practice with things. So one thing that's been extremely helpful for me is the deliberate practice of recognizing in the moment, in the present now, that I'm basically all right. The brain is an expectation machine. It does mental time travel. It goes into the past. It goes into the future. That helps us survive fine. But as much as you can right now, are you basically all right? And feel it. and let your body disengage from habitual anxiety, the habit of anxiety when it's not necessary. Be anxious when it's necessary and useful. Otherwise, it's delusional and not helpful. That's one. Second, be aware of what a good person you are. What a taboo. We can look at others, go, oh yeah, you're basically a good person. But to feel yourself like you really are a loving, strong, caring, honorable, moral, good person. To know that, that's not arrogance and narcissism. Actually, when we let it land, that deep down I'm a fundamentally good person, we then are more lived by the goodness within us. We give over to it. We surrender to the goodness that's already within us rather than top down trying to be a good person. And also, when you know deep down in your bones you're a fundamentally good being, you get less narcissistically hungry. You're less motivated to impress others and get their approval and so on. So that would be a second huge practice. Just know that you're a fundamentally good person. And then the last thing I would say, for me, that's a good thing for people to develop is, like you said, the loving heart. You know, the heart is a physical and it's a psychological muscle. It's maybe even a spiritual muscle. And there's evidence that you can strengthen your heart from this. And I've done that myself a lot in life to kind of move from head to heart. And yeah. And I'll just leave you with this one. Radical gratitude. Right? Even though it's weird, it's wacky, we live in a blessed time. So many of our ancestors have struggled and fought and died, including obviously in the Jewish people, so we could be here today in our different ways. And, you know, every moment is an extraordinary gift, really. 13.8 billion years since the Big Bang. It was a Big Bang. And here we are today. Wow, thank you. And we're in this little weird rocky planet twirling around a kind of a mediocre middling sun in a podunk galaxy amidst 2 trillion other galaxies in the universe. Whoa, what an opportunity. So fuck them. Live well, meanwhile, as best you can.
That is such an absolutely divinely beautiful place, I think, to end on for this time. Okay. I think you've given really so much food for thought and so much food for heart. So thank you,
Anouk,
for your
and
clarity.
Really blessings to everyone listening and to all beings, really, in our beautiful, vulnerable world.
Amen. Toda rabba. And yeah, I just want to end to say to everyone listening, you know, if you've been carrying more than you know how to name, you're not alone. And you have people like Rick out there in the world. There really are people that you can turn to and practices you can turn to help you find clarity and groundedness and compassion. So I hope something in this conversation gave you even a small place to rest inside yourself. And I hope it reminded you that resilience is not about being unaffected. It's about finding connection, even when everything feels uncertain. And we'll be sharing a short guided practice based on this conversation in the next episode. For now, thank you for being here. Thanks, Rick.
That's it for today. Thank you for listening to Raw. You can subscribe on any podcast platform and join our community at withanouk.com. Share this episode if it resonated with you, and I'll see you next time.